I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to Past Imperfect. I'm Alice Thompson.
And I'm Rachel Sylvester, and we're talking to extraordinary people who've overcome trauma or adversity to achieve great success.
Our guest today is the Queen of Shops, best known for her retail and business shows, her creative agency, and her appointment by the then Prime Minister David Cameron to lead a review into the future of Britain's high streets.
The sight of her bright orange bob and vertiginous heels caused shopkeepers to tremble, either in delight or horror, as she dispensed her honest advice.
She is, of course, Mary Portas. The middle of five children, she had a stable, happy childhood growing up in Watford, until two tragedies meant that she had to give up her dreams of becoming an actress to look after her younger brother.
We once asked her how she had become so successful, and she replied, "Empathy. I understood how it felt to be penniless and lost, and I knew the importance of shopping, even when everything else has disappeared."
Mary, thank you very much for joining us. Your hair is actually now blonde, isn't it? So it looks fantastic, but it must take some getting used to every morning.
It's blonde and grey, actually. I'm embracing this time of life, as it were. Yeah, I was in lockdown and everyone thought it was just so funny sending pictures to me saying, "What are you going to do about your hair?" And I had to do a TV interview in the news, and I remember ringing my hairdresser, going, "Well, I'll do it in the garden, Mary. I'll get the colourist round." And then I suddenly just felt, no, this is my next sort of stage in my life. I'm not going to do this anymore. And it felt like I was sort of, it was my past. It was a time, it was a place, it was a look, it was me then, but it's not now.
And what about heels? Are you still wearing them, or is it now just trainers and wellies?
Well, who's wearing heels around the house? It is trainers, I'm afraid. And I've actually, do you know what I've got on today? I've got an old pair of very old Marni, Marni mules that were like clogs, and they're fantastic. So, you know, I'm all about recycling and upcycling, girls. So these ones are about 15 years old.
What about shopping? Do you like shopping online, or have you missed the actual shops as much as everyone else?
I don't really like shopping that much. I know that, and that's the truth. I suppose it's the interaction when I see great product, great people who know about the product in a great space that just gives that little joy into your heart. Then to me, that is what I call great shopping. We have gone through, I think, the last 30 years of pretty mediocre retailing, and we lost that joy. And I'm not just talking about the small businesses, although most of the small businesses have had to put that at the center of their businesses, because the interaction with people is so important. So I do some online stuff on a practical sense. It isn't anywhere near as joyful if you get a great shopping experience. Sadly, though, most shopping experiences weren't joyful. And I know we've seen a huge amount of big retailers, you know, go down over the last, well, certainly the last year. But somehow I'm kind of can't wait for this new creative explosion that's going to happen, because I think we're going to see some really great innovation happening back in retail, particularly digitally and physically, because I think the big players that were just pumping stuff at us for years just made it deeply boring, quite frankly. So I haven't loved it. I love it when it's great, but it's not something that's, oh, I must go and do shopping for a kick. It's probably the last thing I'd choose to do.
What did you feel when companies like Topshop went under? Was it nostalgic, or did you feel that it was time for a change and move on?
No, you see, I think the businesses have a lifespan. There's no two ways about it. Some that disappears early. I think it was tragic when Woolworths went down, because, I mean, actually, if you looked at what Woolworths was, initially what that business was serving, you know, people with everything under a cent. It was, that was the original, everything you could buy under one roof. Now the pound shop replaced that without the soul of Woolworths, but Woolworths was really missed. And I thought that was a terrible miss. Topshop, what it stood for culturally, was fantastic. It was iconic. I trained there. Jane Shepherdson and I were both on the little management training scheme there together at the same age. And it had a vibrancy and it had a rhythm and it had a frequency and an energy that was extraordinary. You know, the music would be pumping out. You'd go down those escalators. There was always something new. And I think girls still want that. I think the however, and I think this is really important, at the heart of these businesses needs to be a true understanding of those girls, how they are living. This was Topshop's market I'm talking about, particularly here. Mm. What their frequency is, what their rhythms of life is, and what inspires them. And I think, sadly, what happened with that was, you know, we had an organisation that was operationally slick, but without soul. And I think it's a real miss. I think that site where it is going to be a real miss. We all met there over the years, and it was iconic. But, you know, we all know the reasons why it happened. And, you know, these businesses that were run by people like Sir Philip were the ones who were knighted for making a lot of money. That's what you got knighted for, making a truckload of cash, but not actually giving anything back or creating social progress or doing anything for society. Mm. I'm not sure those are going to be the businesses we'll see in the future. Well, we won't. That's what we will have learned through COVID.
And how's your younger son, Horatio? Have you been homeschooling him?
Oh, God, I did the first lot. Honestly, I nearly put myself over the edge. There was one point where I was doing a Radio 4 show. I was doing a podcast. I'm writing a book on rebuild, how to rebuild back better businesses, and my agency. And I was doing homeschooling, and I honestly found it just so incredibly difficult. An eight-year-old, you know, it's very difficult. So everybody had to key in. But sorry, the last lockdown, I had to say, you know, sorry to the ex-wife, he's yours for a few weeks. Gleefully handed him over. I found it just, at first it was all like, oh yes, let's go and lovely up the hill and we'll draw a picture and we're going to learn about the plants. And then I was like, it was just too much. I couldn't do it. I've read, you know, women who have got businesses, and women have really suffered through this because the lion's share has been on their shoulders, unbelievably. And it's just been extraordinarily difficult. I mean, when the schools opened up, I mean, we were running it through the gates with him, running.
We want to take you back to your own childhood. And it sounds like a very happy childhood to begin with in a large Irish family just outside London in Watford. And what was your mother like? Was she very strict or was she quite entertaining?
Oh, she was a mix of both. She was a very strong woman, fiery redhead, you know. You didn't mess with my mother. You know, I remember always trying to get by on doing something. She'd find you out. And I'd think, why don't I even try that? You know, she was on it. She was fiercely about education. And so, you know, she came over from Ireland and her whole thing was, you know, I'm going to educate these kids. And I was lucky enough that, you know, through the Catholic Church, that was the only lucky thing about the Catholic Church, that the education system that they had were these grammar schools that were often run by the monks or the nuns. So my brothers were all shipped off to Salvatorian College in Harrow, and I was St. Joan of Arc school. But my mother was, I mean, she'd be teaching us algebra and she would be reading poetry to me and talking about John Donne. And you'd think, how did this little woman, you know, she wasn't so small, but from a farming family. My grandfather was a farmer, but he also was a poet and played the violin. So, you know, but to her, this was education was the way forward. And I remember vividly my sister coming home and saying, Mom, I looked at the register and I was number two in the class. And who was number one? You didn't get away with much. So great. And you know, I'm grateful to her for that. An extraordinarily strong, a multifaceted woman. And very lucky, which gave me a great start in life.
And were you the naughtiest of the family?
You know quite well I was the naughtiest. I really, really was. I think, you know, looking back, I don't know. My mother did say to me, God, if I'd had you first, I think I'd have stopped, which was in my memory forever. I was number four. But I think a lot of it was to do with the fact of where I was. I remember so vividly thinking, I'm not the eldest child. You know, Michael was always, you know, he was always precious and clever and did everything so beautifully. And then my sister was the firstborn daughter, so I got her hand-me-downs. And then my brother Joe. And then I was sort of stuck in the middle, and then Lawrence was the baby. And I remember not feeling I had a place. And so I just put up with, you know, just trying to express myself, which in the end, the stage was my gift. I suddenly thought, this is where I'm meant to be, you know. I stood on the stage when I was 13 and got given a little, you know, role in some school play. So I was always probably wanting attention. Whether it was good or bad, as long as I got it, you know. So, yes, I was very naughty.
And was your father around much? Because he was a sales manager, wasn't he? Or was your mother always the centre of your universe?
Oh, she was definitely the centre of the universe. But, I mean, he was very prominent. I mean, you know, he was very strong, very tall, 6'2" man and very handsome man, you know. So, but he wasn't very touchy-feely. I remember we'd go off to church and I'd want to hold his hand. It was so big, you know, but it was unusual to have that, you know, physical touch from my father. And he was very much the role of, you know, he was the one making the money. And so it's all hushed tones when Dad came in to the house. And you felt that power, that male power, which was set the tone, you know, and if he was in a bad mood, you felt it. But he was also deeply playful. And I don't want to be unfair to him. He was a playful man. So he would, you know, get out and kick football with my brothers in his shoes. There wasn't such a thing as trainers in the 70s, 60s and 70s, in your shoes, playing football. Or say, I'll race you all around the block. And he would run, you know, we'd all be running with him. So he was a spirited, funny individual, witty and clever. But she was definitely the backbone who ran everything.
Then one day when your father was travelling, your mother fell ill. Can you just tell us what happened?
Yeah, I had just finished my O-levels, it was the summer, and I came home from school, and I remember it was a really hot summer, and my brother Michael said, Mum's in bed, and I'm like, oh, she's not well. Now, I never know my mother to ever be in bed. I remember Christmas that she had the flu and, you know, still coming out and doing everything, and I said, really? And he said, she's really, you know, not well. And I knew she'd not been well. She'd had this sort of head cold. She was complaining about headaches, but I was 16. You know, you kind of don't take notice at all. You know, I was in my world. Great, just finishing my O-levels, going to meet my pals afterwards. We were going to play a game of tennis. And I remember going back to the house to get the tennis racket. And I said, I'll pop up and see her. And I went up into her bedroom and I said, Mummy, I'm going up the road. I remember I was going out with my friend Geraldine. I'm going up to play tennis. And should I get you some lemonade? You know, and she said, what's lemonade? I remember this really cold thing. I was like, Mummy, lemonade. And she's gone, oh, yeah. But she started to ramble. And I just remember thinking, I've got to get out of the room. I was so frightened. I'm just like, what's it like? And all I could think of is she having a breakdown, because I knew an aunt that had suffered with depression. I was thinking, is it that? And I remember running downstairs and my sister was away on holiday. She'd left and it was her first holiday away with her girlfriends. So she was 18. Michael was at university but had come back for the summer. And Lawrence, my younger brother, is only 14. So he was out playing with friends. And I remember saying, Michael, Mummy, stop talking sense. And he said, I know, it doesn't look good. And I remember going off to play tennis. And then my father was away. And coming back, he rang that night. And my brother going, Mummy's not well at all. She's just not, you know, and he was like, oh, well, I'll be back in 2 days. Just keep an eye on her. And within a day, she was just talking complete nonsense. And we knew something was really wrong. So Michael was driving, got her into the car. And this is how crazy it is. We were ringing the doctor's surgery and they wouldn't come out. I looked back at her, you know, they were like, bring her down, bring her down. And I remember sitting in the car and also, you know, this is just so awful, but that embarrassment that my mother was sitting in the room, the waiting room, talking rubbish and people were looking. And I'm like, this is my mother. You know, it's that awful 16-year-old where you're in this state of shock, but you're also embarrassment. And you don't know what to do. And you don't know how to manage this at all. And the doctor said, she's going through the menopause and she's obviously, it's affected her mentally. Yeah. Then sent her back home with us with I can't even remember what tablets he gave her. And she got worse. Then my brother phoned an ambulance and she was taken very speedily in. And they actually said it was meningitis, but then encephalitis. So she died 2 weeks later.
Oh, my goodness. It must have been terrifying because there just weren't any adults who were taking you seriously. Was that the thing that was the most frightening for you, really? That sense that everything was out of control and no one was there to help?
Yes. I saw, you know, I talk about this in my autobiography, but the power that the church held, the power that the doctor held, the power that the teachers held, you know, where parents didn't question, not that they shouldn't have, you know, some sense of authority in what they do. Of course. But my parents' generation, she didn't question that. So what the doctor said, you know, or the priest, you know, you listened. If the teacher said this, you listened. And my father was like, well, if that's what the doctor said when he came home, you know, that's what she's got. And you're like, what? You know. And so my brother was, thank God, more alert. And but yes, it was, you know, I could look back and say, oh, God, if we'd have got her in, she'd have survived. But this was her journey and this is my journey. You know, I've looked at that in life because you can end up really just painting yourself so deeply over this.
And who told you she had died? How did you find out?
So she went into the hospital and we used to go and visit her every afternoon. When my father got back, we'd all go down. But she went into a coma. So it was just really waiting for her to recover. And then we got a phone call one afternoon and they said, would you come down? And we just thought she'd taken a turn for the worse. The doctor wants to see us. And they told us that she'd passed away half an hour before.
It must have been so shattering. But you were then left with your younger brother and your father. How was that? Was anyone able to help you in any way at all? Or did you feel totally stranded and alone?
I think it felt more lonely because my sister then went off to UCH to train, and she left home. It was that summer. She was 18, so she just left. Michael went back to university. Joe had started work, so he was out of the house. So my father, I was left from this sort of vibrant house of all these children. It felt like, you know, not only the death of my mother, it just felt this completely different place. And my father, all of this, his, you know, reliance on my mother just showed up so painfully. You know, he just became, he went into such grief that became the focus. You know, he would come home and just cry and play old music that she and he and she used to listen to in our front living room. And I would be left with Lawrence trying to make dinner or manage the house. And I can even physically kind of feel and smell it, you know. It just felt like this is not my home. This is not, it was just a horrible pain of not knowing where you were, this cotton wool existence, being put on to run the house at 16 and 14, you know, Lawrence and I, with a father who just removed himself into a place of grief. And also slight, you know, what am I going to do with my life? I'm 50, you know, he's I'm 50. And you think, yeah, well, we're 16 and 14. And he'd say, you've got your life ahead. And he wasn't looking at these two young people who were in grief. And I look at it now and think, I remember my headmistress calling me in and saying, you know, wonderfully, you know, we're here if you need anything. But that was kind of it. And it just felt like, I do remember thinking, but I am 16, I'm old enough, I should be able to do this, you know. So it's a very dark few years, and I don't remember too much. And interesting, sometimes we talk about it, my siblings and I, and we all have different memories of it. But one for sure is that it was a closure of the first part of your life. It was a closure of your childhood. It was a closure of family. It was a closure of those wonderful spirited times of that lovely infrastructure and web of security that just went.
And your father met another woman soon after the funeral, didn't he? That must have just been ghastly for you, the idea that he felt he could move on and leave you behind.
I think we were, we slightly pushed that way. I remember my sister's boyfriend's mother said, you need to get him out. He needs to go out. And there were these little clubs, you know, for widows and widowers that they'd meet. And he came home one day with this ghastly woman, and within sort of 6 months said, I'm going to marry her, married her, left us in the family home and moved in with her into her home, and used to come around once a week and leave money for us to get our food shopping. And, you know, we were like, you know, so this was what, 17 and a half, and Lawrence would have been not even 16.
Was it hard to forgive him? Or have you forgiven him, or do you still feel angry with him?
No, we've forgiven him. Both Lawrence and I, it was Lawrence and I who really got affected. Lawrence wrote a letter to say that he'd forgiven him.
Because you were effectively homeless. What happened? Did you have to move in with other people, or did you manage to keep the family home, or how did you have the finances?
No, what happened was he died. He died 9 months later of a heart attack. So she got our family home. She'd been married to him 9 months. So we all had to move out.
Oh, my goodness.
So none of us remember the day moving out. And it's such a trauma because at the weekends, my sister used to come back. She was staying in London, so she was at UCH. So she'd come back. Michael would come back. So we'd all be together at the weekends. It was something I looked forward to. So we all had to clear our family home. But none of us has one memory at all of leaving that house.
Oh, that's fascinating. Mm. So where did you go and live?
Well, I did a TED talk on this in kindness, and it's always the people who have so little who come in, isn't it? Mm. So when my father came over from Ireland, he had two friends, Don McInerney and Harry McCann. And Harry and Sheila married a woman called Sheila, had four kids, and they put us up in their house, three-bedroom, semi-detached council house, four kids, and brought us in.
And you once said that the shopkeepers helped to feed you and your brother and sort of gave you bits of uniform, and when you came off the bus, they were there. Did that engender your sort of love of retail in any way, do you find? I mean, did you feel that the high street was there for you in an extraordinary way?
I've always talked about this. Yes, of course, I'm sure that in my heart, that was somewhere where this was a web of security, that there was a place where when I got off a bus, you knew the faces of the people, the shopkeepers. It wasn't a faceless, closed up, you know, space. And so that to me was a saviour of those. I'd go into the butchers and say, this is what your mother had on a Wednesday. And the greengrocer would leave in little notes on how to steam stuff. I had no idea why I was. Mm. That was, I remember there was a tiny little Boots at chemist, and Jenny, who worked there, you know, who was my mother's age, used to come out and just give me a hug and go, how are you going, kid? You know, like, because my mother would pop in there. So this isn't nostalgia when I talk about this. This is a human need that we've let go in our chase for capitalism. We've created retail parks and we say, this is what people want. Have you ever been to a retail park off the side of some motorway, grey spaces where they build places that sell stuff? And we go, yeah, that's what we want. No, no. We let it go. We let it go in our chase for selling more stuff, for cheaper spaces where these huge out-of-town places could be built. And we let this go. And here's the beauty of what's happened in COVID, is we've realised the importance of it, that actually we need that. And that little web of security and that connection with a place is what value is today. It's not just about cheap stuff and how much stuff that we can be buying. So that is why I will constantly fight for high streets to be a part of how we live. I mean, there's some incredible stuff that's going on across the world on this. We're having to do it now, where they're looking at 15-minute cities, where you can have all your needs within a 15-minute walk or cycle. We've been pushed into this. So it will happen if we get government that actually understands this and realises that it's not just about plonking more housing there. We need these places that feed our needs and lives. And that is what helped me through a time. And I looked at my kids, Milo and Verity, when they were that age, 16 and 14. And I was like, if something happened to me, would you know the people locally in the shops? Or do you have to drive out some faceless place or go online to just get this delivered? Very different.
Mm.
You know, we talk about it takes a village to raise a child. It does. It does. And I think that's one thing we've learned through this time.
You're listening to Past Imperfect with Alice Thompson, Rachel Sylvester, and our guest this week, the retail guru, Mary Portis.
We'll be back after this. To celebrate the beginning of spring, save 50% on full digital access to The Times and The Sunday Times for 6 months and stay well informed on the latest stories. Visit thetimes.co.uk/sale/past-imperfect and subscribe today.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome back to Past Imperfect with Alice Thompson, Rachel Sylvester, and our guest this week, Mary Queen of Shops, Mary Portis.
To lose two parents within 2 years feels, it must have been terrible, had a terrible impact on you. Did it feel as if the world was just incredibly cruel?
No, I never felt that. Never felt that. Don't know. I've never felt I've been in a cruel world. I've never felt I've had anything less. I've felt incredibly lucky.
And what happened to your stepmother?
Oh, God knows. I bumped into her. I did. I remember years later when I gave birth to Milo and Verity, and I was with my husband, and I had these little babies. So, you know, there's only 20 months between Milo and Verity, and I had Milo, and Verity was playing up, crying. So Graham said, I'll go out with the baby. And as I turned the corner, she was there. So I was with Milo, this little toddler, and my heart just went pumping. And it's that moment of you where you think, shall I just walk past or shall I say something? And she said, hello. I said, it's Mary. She had no idea. I looked differently than the scraggy little thing at 16 who was going through trauma and pain. And she said, I'm sorry. I said, Sam's daughter, Mary. It's Mary Newton. She went, Mary, how are you? This, how are you? I said, I'm really fantastic. This is my son, Milo, and my husband's outside with my little daughter, and I'm well, and my life is happy. Are you able to say the same about yours after all you took from us? I hope you are. And I turned, and I walked so fast, and as I got out, I just broke down crying, and this grief and this pain of so many years went through me. My husband thought I'd been had up for shoplifting or something weird had happened. But it was as if I didn't want to just be bitter, but I just wanted to know I was in a safe place. I was in safety. And I had these children I'd love. I was all right. I wanted her to know that. But I don't think you can ever forgive what you do. Oh, well, I wouldn't have been able to ever live with myself had I done what she did.
Because you also had to sacrifice quite a lot for your career in a way, because you got into RADA and you were going to be an actress, you wanted to be an actress. What happened? Did you feel you had to give that up, really, because of what had happened to you?
Well, to go to RADA, I'd have had to go into London. I didn't have the money. I had no support, no financial support. Lawrence would have been left out. Where's he going to be? Mm. So this was just, you know, it was just an awful mix. And I thought, I can't. The two of us were in this together. Mm. Also, on top of that, though, I think, which is vitally important, I remember going for my audition for RADA, and, you know, you're at this free time, most people are going into RADA, you're expressing yourself, you know, you want to be an actor. And I remember thinking, I didn't feel free enough to connect with deeply with myself in order to perform. I'm not going to be able to do this. I just didn't. I was in grief. I was just surviving, and I put on an outward shell, and I don't think I was ready to take that off.
Do you regret now missing out on those teenage years in the early 20s and the partying and the having fun? Or do you realise that it just gave you some sort of resilience that you wouldn't have had otherwise?
I think it did. I mean, I don't regret it. I've never done drugs, so I missed out on all that. And everyone's going, ooh, but I've never done that, didn't it? But I didn't do any. I never went into that crazy space of clubbing. You know, I did when I started at Harrods, I'd go, but I never found that ever fed my soul anyway. It was never like, whoa, whoa. I don't know. I didn't ever feel that that was me. I really do feel I've missed out on time where I've been able to discover who I was. I think it took a long time to discover my soul, my energy, my who I truly was. Because I was surviving. And when you survive, you just create this modus operandi that just keeps going. And I felt I could do anything, you know, in any problem. I took on. And I do look, I think, I don't think I've ever stopped. I don't think I really ever even now have taken that time where I'm just going to be about me. Yes, where you really have that time where you're free. No. I've never had that. Do I regret it? I don't have any regrets at all. It would be nice to feel it at some point.
And by the age of 30, you were creative director and on the board of Harvey Nichols. Did work in a way become your salvation and your way to escape those teenage traumas?
Yes. I mean, I think I found what was fantastic there is, you know, it was, I found where I was meant to be. And the job that I had was a creative expression with huge, you know, lump of commerce behind it. But I loved the mix of that. So I loved putting my business head on, but actually being free to experiment and use my creativity, because I think the two, you know, it's like a physics and a chemistry. I love the chemistry of business. I enjoyed the physics. I knew the physics, but the chemistry is what made it exciting for me. And I think, and I was free. It was interesting, actually, that because I went in when it was a loss-making business and we had to turn it around. And so it was experimenting and just doing what I wanted. It was the first time I truly felt I was connecting with my energy and being who I was and creating this frequency and work that just, you know, became very, very well known and actually made the brand very famous. So, and I think that's why I ended up being on the board. And interestingly, though, once I got onto the board, that's when you constrain yourself and you go back in because you think you've got to play this role and you've got to play the role of the physics and be this alpha person who's on a business board. And I actually found that was the worst thing to do to me because I lost that creative spirit in doing so, which is why I left.
And did you become too much of a workaholic, do you think? I mean, you must have been working absolutely flat out the whole time. Do you think in retrospect that probably wasn't the right thing to do? Or do you feel in the 80s and 90s that's what it was all about?
I don't think I was a workaholic. I don't think I've ever been a workaholic. I work in a very, I think the word's peripatetic. I know it's physically peripatetic, but I think mentally I do lots of small things that with an energy. And it feeds me and it's how I like to operate. So... but I'm not one of those up at, you know, 5:30, do my yoga, do a call to chakra. oh my God. You know, there's women that used to put always on the front cover of the Sunday Times. Yes, you can have it all. And you think, no, you can't. So I'm really not that. And I'm always amazed at people that trudge through work on their laptop for hours and hours. My brain won't work like that. That would really, really eke my little soul out. So I don't do that. So I'm one that does lots of things and, you know, I nip in and out and I put an infrastructure underneath me of people that pick up the balls and are brilliant and I couldn't be without them. So but I'm not a workaholic and I don't like that. I wouldn't like to think that I'm losing out on you know doing stuff that feeds me, whether that's reading poetry or whether that's going to see a play or whether that's, you know, being outside walking with the dog. I couldn't limit myself to just work. That would make me a deeply boring person. I know it would. And it would actually just suppress me. So no, I wasn't a workaholic, but if I loved what I was doing, I wanted to be the best. And I'd keep on at it until I got it to a great, great place. And I loved that. But that was joy. That was joy. But I didn't ever compromise my children. So I was always at their sports days. I made sure I put them to bed at night. I made sure I had supper with them. And there were times where I was like to get back when you're caught with meetings, of course. But I would never, I don't think for women as a workaholic.
Was it hard reaching the age your mother was when she died?
Yes. My sister and I both talk about that.
How did you feel?
I felt okay. It wasn't me so much. Actually, my daughter went through a terrible year of fear on that, where, you know, she wasn't so much different age till when she hit 16, she was like, Mama, please look after yourself. And she got quite
right.
It's gone into the family that this, you know, this trauma did hit. And, you know, she was really troubled by it, you know, to the extent that a friend of mine used to just meet with her and talk with her and did, you know, this just sort of Reiki and energized her, and she got through it, but it was her who took it more than anything.
Did you always feel that you didn't have much time after that? That there was a sense that life is short and you just had to pack it in?
No, I don't do that. I don't compromise on my life. So I have the sort of the analogy or the metaphor of going to the theatre. If the play's not great, I won't go back in for the second half. And my life's out. I'm like, well, if this isn't making me, and I know I can sit with something and I can feel in my frequency and my soul that this isn't making me happy, so I will change. So I have a lot of change in my life. I'll move on. I'll shift. I'll go there. I'll do this. So I don't think, oh, it's got to be packed in. I think I am so not going to settle and compromise. That might be the same thing. I don't know. I've not analysed that, but I really do throw the cards up in the air if this isn't working. And that gives me to create that sense of harmony in myself and joy, because I think, why would I compromise? Why am I going to settle? So maybe it's much the same.
And you were happily married to Graham, a Unilever executive, for years, and you had two children. Did you have a sense that you wanted to give them that stable, normal, happy life, as it were, that you didn't have as a child? Were you always craving to create that?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, to the extent I think I went a little bit over the top with it, you know. Yeah, I really, really did.
What did you do?
Well, it would just be that I'm always one. So it would be that, you know, family was really important. So high holidays, whatever it was, Christmas, come Easter, everyone had to be round. We were going to do those lunches, Sunday lunches. And my brother's been like, oh, God, Mary's on the phone again. You know, I was like, come on, uncle's up. Yeah, and it was a joyful place. I've always done that, though. And so I thought that was just important that they knew family, that there was this, you know, this infrastructure that was there constantly for them. And so I became the matriarch in the family, you know, and everybody would come to me at Christmas and it'd be planned and exactly. And if anybody was like, Mary, I've got to go here. What do you mean? Well, you can't go on holiday then. That's ridiculous. We've all got to be together. So I... You know, we laugh now. It's still blooming going on. But so, yes, that was really important. But I also, you know, was when Graham and I separated, I also wasn't willing to just say, I'm going to settle when we're both unhappy here. This isn't working. I'm not going to settle because that's not going to give me the joy to give them the joy. Quite simply that. And we can do this and have a familial relationship and still be in each other's lives, but not married. So even that, you know, it took, I prioritized absolutely how we were going to do that with the children.
And when you met Melanie, did you instantly know that you wanted to be with her?
Yes, I did. Very powerfully so, yeah. And yes, and that was quite a change. See how I like change, girls? That was quite a change in life. And also at a time, I was, you know, going a bit of a public figure, but not as much as I later became. But, you know, this really was, there were very few single sex relationships at my children's schools, parents. Very unusual. You know, what am I talking about now? 2003. So it was quite a thing to change too, not just for me, but for how I brought my children through that as well.
And how did they feel about it? What did they say?
Well, they were young, and there's a really wonderful story that I tell. I did the opening speech at Pride, and I opened with this story because I think it was really important that, you know, I talked about what love was. And I remember so vividly. So Verity was seven, and she was at her little school, and her friend was leaving to go to another school. And I remember it so vividly that we were sitting at the table, and I was dating Mel, but they didn't quite know. You know, I was seeing Mel, and I was being slowly introducing her into the family. And we're sitting at the supper table, and Milo's there, Verity's next to me, and she's writing this little card, and I had this very Catholic nanny, who was sitting very seriously eating her supper. And Verity was writing a card, and she just said to me, "How do you spell lesbian?" And I remember just sort of thinking, oh my God, I'm giving off these pheromones to my child. And I, this sort of confusion, like, what's she writing? And so I remember, and Milo said, "Yeah, Verity's a lesbian." I said, "Oh, right, okay." this is all going a bit weird. Anyway, so I give her the spelling, and I just, L-E-S-B-I-A-N. I'm thinking, what's going in the card? What's going in the card? You know, and I'm thinking, God, this mother is going to read this card that my daughter's sending to her daughter. And I know this mother, she's quite strict and quite straight. Anyway, I picked up the card after we'd cleared supper and read it, and it was so sweet. She said, "I am so going to miss you. You are like a sunflower." Beautiful little analogy. "You make me happy. I love you. Love, Verity. P.S. Lesbian." So my producer, Pat Llewellyn, said, "That's the title of your autobiography." I just thought it was brilliant. But it summed up to me, the word lesbian meant love.
Right.
That was beautiful. I remember doing this talk at Pride and saying, so when I eventually said, "Look, Mummy, you know, is in love with a woman," and I explained it to her, and she thought this was fantastic and told lots of people at school. And then she came home one day, you know, she was about nine, saying, "I'm being teased, Mummy. They're saying about you." And I was like, "Yeah, don't," you know, she was feeling sad for me, because they were saying, "Your mother's gay," which was the worst thing you could say in a playground to anyone. "You're gay. You remember that? That awful thing. She's so gay." And Milo found that very difficult. And so when Milo went to Westminster School and he was starting, I rang every mother. I said, "I want you to know I'm in a relationship with a woman. I want you to tell your son." And they were like, "Oh, of course. So that I didn't want him. And he didn't have one day's teasing, he said. But it wasn't easy at first.
But you married Mel, didn't you, in one of the first, well, the very first gay marriages. That must have felt really incredible, didn't it, at the time?
Oh yeah, it was. It was fantastic. And you know, just proud to be in a country that was allowed, you know, that realised that this is what we should be doing. It's crazy that we even, you know, still talking about, it's still a big issue worldwide, which is just utterly, utterly crazy.
You wrote a book called Work Like a Woman. Do you think there is an equal balance yet, or do you think things in some ways are going backwards now?
Well, I think when we look at the stats of what's happened in COVID and the amount of women who percentage-wise have lost their jobs and are taking is huge compared to men. I don't know the stat off the top of my head. I'm sure you'll be able to find it. And the amount of care that's taken, the women are picking it up. I think this has really not been great for women, that's for sure. You know, it was a manifesto for change. I think the manifesto was more about how we can also change culture in business from this linear, individualistic, alpha way of working. And most men don't really want to work like that. So it's interesting. It's had huge traction, and so many people have written books, you know, subsequently, probably some that are much better. But, and, you know, this is something that we need to keep on the agenda constantly. And the businesses, the big thing is that most women don't want to work within corporations that, quite frankly, are run in an alpha way. And that's what we have to shift. We have to shift the way business is done. Which is on to my next book, girls.
Well, that's what, I mean, the pandemic has allowed us to consider a different way of living. It's been tragic in so many ways, but, you know, we have been thinking about working at home, or only 14% of people actually want to go into an office full time. Do you think now is the time when we can really embrace quite a lot of your ideas?
I think it totally is. And, you know, there was a wonderful philosopher called Gershom Scholem who talks about the plastic hours. And often that's when you have a time to make change happens because of something that's happened. He wrote this after the Holocaust, you know, saying this is the time where there is a window where you say we will never go back to the way we were. And this is the plastic hours where we can change these times. And we are in that now. And I think we need to look at what the way that we will live has fundamentally changed. I do think that businesses need to be careful not wanting to open up offices, because I think the well-being and the social connection, particularly for the younger generation, is vital. So I think there is going to be a balance. But I think, you know, the cost cutting would be easy to say we all work from home. But what do you miss out? It's again like saying, you know, we don't need our local high streets and our shops. What do you miss out? And you have to understand what that value is. So I think there is going to be a change. I think people will be coming out with great and new ways of working. And I think we are with something that's come out. I call it the COVID cleanse, you know, and the COVID conscience that's come out of this is that we've realized, you know, so much that it's about we and not me anymore. That we really, this is about us on a world level as we. This has affected everybody. And therefore, it's made us rethink how we are connecting with people, how we are living our lives, what we are doing to this planet as well, and what we are doing for our own well-being and what's important to us.
And are you pleased now that you didn't go to RADA? Because in a way, you would have made a great actress, but in some ways, you're still performing, but in a way that connects to the real world. Do you think it's been more fulfilling, perhaps, the way things worked out?
Well, you wouldn't. I'd never know. I don't have any regrets. I've had an extraordinary time, and my life is always really very interesting. And well, I find it interesting. And you know, I'm always excited and waking up to think about what I'm doing next. So, it was my journey. I can't say, you know. And of course, I've put performative into the heart of what I do, whether that's on TV, whether that's doing radio, whether that's me presenting to clients. You know, it's the heart of what I do. But I think, through the business link, I've been able to, and through my public persona, hopefully have a voice that will enable change for the better. And I look back and I think, you know, I was given that business training, and I've been given a platform through the media, TV and radio, to become a public figure. And I think that's all coming together in what I see my role now as a 60-year-old woman is to actually do something that is really going to make a change and talk about this. So on my book Rebuild, it's how, you know, a cry for business, like I did in Work Like a Woman, to think about what we're doing for people and this planet, and to change, you know, what the tenets of capitalism without a conscience were. And if I can use that, then I'd like to, you know, when I do go clogging it in my old in my deathbed, then at least I think I've done something with all that I learned, where I was, you know, selling and helping businesses sell more stuff to a planet that quite frankly didn't need it. And it's a bit of a mea culpa.
And do you think that being on your own when you're in your late teens gave you that impetus to succeed, that you had to provide for your brother, you had a reason that you had to work?
Yes, it's utterly, there was no way out. I remember so vividly when I was at Harvey Nichols, you know, a girl coming in to hand a notice in. And it was a fantastic job that one of the creative teams. And I said, why are you going? She said, oh, I just fancy 3 months out. And you know, I might go off here, there, and everywhere. And I was like, oh, my God, I don't have that choice. I hadn't even thought that you could take 3 months out to do whatever. Because there was never that choice for me. And I think that did, you know, I just was there and making a success because I had no option. Even when you have, you know, I was times where I had to have bosses who were complete arseholes, you know, and you'd love to walk. I couldn't. I had to keep my, you know, I had to make the money. And I think I learned through that. I learned how to compromise. I learned how to negotiate. I learned how to work around that situation and make their, shine some of their egos. You learn to be adaptable, all to survive.
And if you could go back to yourself when you were 16 and your mother had just died, what would you say to yourself? How would you reassure yourself?
I, Yeah, it's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, I would just say, I think of, you know, Verity at 16, standing there, what I was saying to her and how much that it's okay. The world will always take care of you. You are going to be safe. You're going to be loved. And the world will take care of you. So go out there and just do your best, kid.
Mary Portis, thank you very much for talking to us.
Always a pleasure, girls. Take care.
You've been listening to Past Imperfect with Alice Thompson, Rachel Sylvester, and our guest this week, Mary Portis.
This is a Wireless Studios production for Times Radio, produced by Ben Mitchell.
For those of you who haven't heard the rest of this series, and even those of you who have, don't forget that you can listen back to us on the Times Radio app.
And you can download episodes from wherever else you get your podcasts. Please don't forget to leave a comment and subscribe when you do.
That's it from us for this series.
But we hope to welcome you back for another Past Imperfect very soon.
Thanks for listening.
If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode or others in this series, please go to our podcast page or website, where there are links to charities and organisations who are there to help.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.